Straight out of Finland, this is the Reluctant Theologian Podcast. I am your host, Dr. R.T. Mullins from the University of Helsinki. Today I'm joined by Dr. Richard Rice to discuss his recent book, The Future of Open Theism. In today's episode, we chat about what open theism is, and then consider some of the history of open theism. Richard gives us some of the gossip about how the 1994 book, The Openness of God, came together. Then we discuss the rather fiery criticisms of that book. Richard explains some of his experiences going through those criticisms, and we chat a bit about theological disagreements in the contemporary world. In the next episode, I'll continue my conversation with Richard about the future of open theism and systematic theology. If you have questions or topics that you'd like to hear on the show, you can send me a message at rtmullins.com. Ready or not, here's Richard and I chatting about the history of open theism. Enjoy! All right, so Rick, you've recently written a book called The Future of Open Theism, and I've got several questions for you about the book, but I wanted to start with some of the basics, I guess. So just in a nutshell, why don't you tell us what is open theism?
Open theism is the view, in a nutshell, that God is open to the world and the world is open to God. God created a world that would have an ongoing series of experiences, and God enjoys the experiences of his creatures in the world as they take place. So that's the basic idea, and it's out of love, so that instead of God determining how everything would happen in the world, God created a world where there would be beings, particularly those created in his image, who would make a contribution as well. And so the ongoing course of events would be the collaborative effort or the result of the collaborative effort of God and his creatures, particularly those of us who are made in his image. Now, from the perspective of most open theists, I would think, God had the power to create the world that would go exactly the way God wanted it to. Mm-hmm. But instead of the world being God's product, it's God's project. Using the contrast that a well-known open theist, John Sanders, uses. Mm-hmm. I like to think of it as, instead of the world being God's invention, it's God's adventure. And of course, we appreciate both in our experience. I like my computer and my car and my machinery to sure, do yeah. exactly what I want it to. Mm-hmm. But that's not enough of a relationship when you come to other parts of life. I wouldn't want my wife to be mechanical in her operations and interactions with me. She brings something to it. So there's an interaction here. And so in a sense, the open view of God says, God created a world that is capable of responding to God in a positive way, and God enjoys the relationship with those who are capable of enjoying their relationship with God.
Okay, so I think that's a really good little snapshot of what open theism is. So with that, let's get into this book here. So there's several different features about your book that I really liked, one of which was the history of open theism that you lay out in the early chapters. So in your mind, what do you think is one of the earliest and clearest examples of open theism in history?
Well, it's going to sound biased, but it's clearly the Bible. I think the open view of God has precedence in the Bible. In fact, I was looking through a book that I have, and I haven't studied it in detail yet, by Manuel Schmidt, if you're acquainted with his work. He's a Swiss theologian, but he's taken a real interest in open theism and written books in German and in English about it. Mm. But he quotes another author, Armin Kreiner, in the book God Im Leib, and I just ran across this the other day, and this is the question, this is the statement that Kreiner makes. One asks oneself how someone who reads the Bible could stumble upon the idea that the biblical God is atemporal, immutable, and unalterable. Nothing seems to contradict the biblical witness more than this idea. So I'm quoting someone because it's perhaps a little stronger than my own formulation would be.
Sure.
And so you can lay the blame on this person if you think that's overstated. But I think that's the thing. Just reading the Bible, you discover that God is creating a world that God enjoys. He's creating beings who have their own contribution to make. It's been pointed out that when God invited Adam to name the animals, there was a sense in which he was inviting Adam to bring them into the full scale of existence, because in the ancient world, nothing fully existed without a name. And the ability to name something, in a sense, was the ability to sort of place it within the scheme of created realities. And of course, we know what happens when names are blotted out and so forth. Mm-hmm. That had a real impact on people. If you visited Rome and you see the names that have been hammered out on the architraves there in the Roman Forum and whatnot, you can see how important that would have been to many people in other cultures. So that capacity to name seems to be that God has invited Adam to participate in the process. So God brings things to a certain point of completion and then says, now, I'm going to let you decide what you want to do from this point on. A little like an artist who says, mm-hmm. why don't you finish the painting for me? Or you decide the colors that should go in now. It shows, I think, great generosity and a capacity to appreciate other things. So that's what I see going on here. In the future of open theism, the precedents I look at are people who have gone more or less directly to the Bible. If you read that chapter, you've got Adam Clark, who of course wrote a commentary that was very widely read. I've inherited mm-hmm. my grandfather's copy of that commentary, and he had questions about what to do with the biblical account. The other figures I refer to were not, I would say, well-known biblical scholars. In fact, at least a couple of them didn't have theological training as such. They read the Bible. Now, they were from an Arminian background, Methodist background, but they read the Bible and they noticed over and over again how God interacts with the world, how there are conditional prophecies. Prophecies are made, they're not fulfilled. Why? Well, because the conditions changed. Did that mean that God had lied about the future or was misleading people? No, it meant that the way things would go in response to the prophecy was open to various possibilities. So I think you see that in the Bible. Mm-hmm. Now, something I might very well have put in the book is that while I was a graduate student, I studied the writings of Alfred North Whitehead and Charles Hartshorne, well-known process philosophers. Sometimes helpful to make a distinction between process philosophers on the one hand and process theologians. Yeah. When you think of process theologians, we think of theologians who are working with process thought, and so they have a natural desire to bring those together. The philosophers were really just trying to make sense out of reality in the complex way in which it presents itself to us. And instead of time being somehow secondary or artificial or whatnot, time becomes essential to the very nature of things. And so this is what Hartshorne and Whitehead were doing. So if you want to go to the level of ultimate reality, and they were metaphysicians, you want to find something that's absolutely basic to the way things are. And they found temporal sequence basic to that. And so it becomes very important. So this is why Whitehead's best known book is Process and Reality. And Hartshorne talks about the divine relativity and so forth. So I might have gone to those two as precedents, but what I think they have in common with the people who went to the figures I mentioned that just basically study the Bible is that neither group, neither the process philosophers nor these proto-open theists were deeply ingrained, deeply influenced by traditional classical theological reflection.
Right.
Because you can't look at classical theological reflection and not be impressed and heavily influenced by the view that, in contrast to the temporal world, God occupies a sphere of eternity.
Right.
In which God's experience is not sequential, it is one time. God sees in one moment all of history. Nothing about God changes, because that seems to reflect the sort of contrast, the invidious contrast, that what changes is superior to, inferior to what doesn't change. The relative is inferior to the absolute. The temporal is inferior to the eternal. And of course, God must be as good as it's possible to be. So none of those contrasts in those pairs can be applied to God.
So when I'm looking at some of these different thinkers, like you pointed out, yeah, like you said, they're not deeply beholden to classical Christian theology. So at least with like the process thinkers, they're happy to just deviate from the norm within theology, where these other thinkers, they're just looking at the Bible and just trying to go, this is just what I see in the text.
That's exactly
yeah.
Point. I think yeah. both provide interesting precedents.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the reason I was reluctant or didn't even think of including the process philosophers was I thought that might raise maybe some real red flags from the beginning, and people are
going, right.
Well, this is just another version of process
yeah.
thought, and that doesn't have anything to do with Christianity.
Exactly, because there's already been a long, hard-fought road to be able to say open theism is not process theism.
Well, so. I worked very hard. I don't know if you've read my essay in the symposium volume that John Cobb and Mark Pinnock edited, but that's where I laid out my own. It was particularly designed to bring together process thinkers and open theists.
This is In Search of an Adequate God?
Yes, searching for an adequate God.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, yeah.
And my contribution there was to identify the similarities between the two, but to take a rather emphatic stand that open theism has some similarities to process thought, but is not just a version of it.
Right. Yeah. So let's actually back up a little bit before that book. So there's an earlier book from 1994 that was just called The Openness of God. And so this was one that you co-authored with Clark Pinnock, William Hasker, David Bassinger, and John Sanders. And that's the book that really like kicked off a lot of these debates in contemporary theology. So why don't you tell me a little bit about how that project came together?
Evidently, Pinnock and Sanders had gotten together in a conference at Wheaton College in the summer of 1992, Sanders told Pinnock about a book idea that he had on the nature of God and providence. And as they talked together, he said he would draw on the biblical material that Karens Fredheim had developed and the philosophical work of William Hasker and the practical theological insights of David Bassinger. Mm. And so he liked what those three had done. Pinnock said he liked the idea and said, in response to Sanders' prediction that it would take him several years to get to it, or at least two, said, why don't you ask those three if they'd be interested in participating? And so they did. And Pinnock and Sanders made their own contribution, and then they asked the other three. Hasker and Bassinger said yes. And evidently, Fredheim said he was not able to participate. Mm. I got an interesting call from Clark Pinnock. He said, we're putting together this symposium volume dealing with various aspects of what was then described as free will theism. And he said, we have all the bases covered. We want to do the biblical, historical, systematic, philosophical, and practical aspects of this position. And we're wondering if you'd do the biblical. And I said, well, Clark, I'm not trained as such to be a biblical scholar. I would suggest Karens Fredheim as the best resource here, because I have relied on his biblical studies as a way of drawing support for our way of looking at God. And Clark, I don't know if I should say being Canadian, was forthright in his response. He said, well, we already asked Fredheim and he turned us down. That's why we're asking you. So, now, I don't tell a lot of people this, but I was not the first choice. So I was, I came in and I said, well, yeah, I'd like to be a part of that. So we were all on board then. And it was, I would say it was a co-edited book. That is to say, each of us sent his offering to all the others, and we all read what everybody had contributed. And then the time came, what shall we call this book? And Clark, which I liked very much, said, you know, I've always liked the title of Rice's original book in 1980. Hard to believe it's been 40 years from now. 1980, I had published a little book about God's relation to the world that basically took this familiar perspective, familiar now. And I was looking for a title, and I called it The Openness of God. I had read a book in graduate school, The Openness of Being. And I thought, well, okay, let's go with that. So Pinnock said, yeah, I like that title because open is a word that has a positive ring to it. The Openness of God is not a title that has any particular theological baggage with it. So this would be, and everybody else came on board. And so that's how the title of the 1994 book arose.
Nice, nice. Okay, so that this book that was quite controversial, and so one of the things that I guess I find so disappointing about the history of open theism is the reaction to the openness of God, so like mainly from within the evangelical community. So maybe you could give the audience an example of the kinds of reactions that evangelical theologians had to open theism, and then, you know, tell us what it was like to hear some of those reactions.
Well, it happened, the reactions came very soon after the publication of the book. And it actually set off something of a firestorm among conservative Christian circles, much to the surprise of its authors. Later, Pinnock said, I didn't for a moment imagine that our book would create such interest and provoke such controversy, particularly in the evangelical community. The intensity of people's reaction morphed into open hostility. And Roger Olson, a well-known evangelical scholar, but not an open theist, said 15 years later that he had never seen something as dismaying and disillusioning as in his experience of being an evangelical as the reaction to open this publication. And the titles of some of the works show how shrill the objections had become. No Place for Sovereignty. What's Wrong with Free Will Theism? God's Lesser Glory, the Diminished God of Open Theism. Bound Only Once, the Failure of Open Theism. And so you get the picture here. Open Theism is painted in the worst possible colors, and it created quite a stir. So that's been the problem, and that's been quite a sad experience for many people. I could go into some detail, but I don't think I will. But two scholars in particular came under serious criticism from the Evangelical Theological Society. And over three successive annual meetings, their work was evaluated. And finally, their membership in the society was up for a vote. And since Pinnock passed without too much of a problem, Sanders managed to squeak by because it required a two-thirds vote to exclude someone from it. And he didn't have a majority, but he didn't have two-thirds against him. And so he was able to stay in it.
Gosh.
I felt personally that I wasn't a member of the Evangelical Theological Society. My own view of biblical inspiration does not lead me to the conclusion of inerrancy. I hope that won't put off some of your listeners. But so I'm not, you know, I'm not a member. So I was spared that, shall we say, although not the criticism of a lot of other
right.
people. So there we are. You know, I don't know if I can toss this in. But it occurs to me that people become more resistant and more critical of positions when they have a kind of an underlying sense that their own view of the issue may be somewhat vulnerable.
Right.
Okay. In other words, as I think I quoted somewhere in the book, somebody said, nothing divides like common beliefs held with a difference. So I think liberal theologian, you know, widely, and there are many, would say that that's fine. These people are entitled to their own position. But people who, you know, who share the presuppositions most of them with open theists, and yet realize that the classical attempt to somehow bring together the idea of genuine human freedom and absolute divine foreknowledge, the attempts to do that have never been entirely satisfactory. There are a lot of them. There are people who find them persuasive. But as I quoted Linda Zagzebski saying once, she reviews them all in one of her, or many of them in one of her books, and at the end just says, I'm ending on a note of resignation because none of these attempts really work and none of them have achieved widespread success. So I can't help wondering if there's a kind of sense that we really don't have a good way to bring these together, and the open theists have put their finger on that, and we're not comfortable with that point in our doctrinal commitments. What do you think?
It fits really well with my experience in the world of theology, because one of the things I constantly do is I'm like, okay, let's look at this sort of classical view. Oh, that's a problem. Everybody knew this problem throughout most of church history. They all try to like come up with different answers to it. I'll just exploit this problem a little bit more. And then I start presenting these things to fellow classmates, to colleagues and whatnot. It didn't quite go so well. They're like, well, everyone had answers to this. And I'm like, yeah, but they weren't happy with them. And then the next generation was like, yeah, they still got some problems here. I'm just doing the same thing. But that it didn't go well. So I can see this. I want to be more charitable, but at the same time, I don't want to be, because I do think that is what is going on. I do think it is you are pushing on people's vulnerable spots, and they're feeling the pain of it, and they don't want to admit it, so they kind of double down.
That's interesting. Well, William Lane Craig and a colleague co-authored an article critical of open theism.
Mm-hmm.
And they worked, you know, they didn't like open theism, neither one of them, but when it turned to their own views, they didn't agree with each other.
Right. Yeah, because it was, I think it's with David time. Hunt.
And
David
right.
Hunt holds simple foreknowledge, whereas Craig has like middle knowledge. And so,
middle
yeah, they disagree.
Molinism.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
They didn't agree, but they both knew that we were wrong, that open
right,
theism
exactly.
was wrong. So
yeah,
we're
yeah.
going to oppose that. Anyway, it's kind of an interesting phenomenon when you look at the history of Christianity and the bitter rivalries sometimes involve people that have a similar back. After all, who can you disagree with except people that you share some presuppositions with?
Right, exactly.
And there you have it, another episode of the Reluctant Theologian Podcast. Stay tuned for more episodes on open theism.